Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Eric Beiler. I am guest hosting for Dan Aronson on Press One for Democracy tonight. Dan, we hope you get better soon. He's under the weather today. I haven't done this in a long time. For our listeners who've been with us for a while, you probably recognize my voice. I used to co-host The Middle Ground with Michael Charney. And the reason I haven't been doing it in part was that Michael decided to take a break from Coffee Party. And I can tell you about that if you guys want to talk about that later in the show. He and I are still friends and still very much in conversation, in this sort of left-right conversation that we have, you know, for a number of years been having. And I tried to do the show for a while without Michael, but it wasn't the same. And also, Annabelle Clark and I have been making a film. It's another interactive documentary, which is a lot of work. What that means is we share with the public the most important of our findings as we find them. It used to be the documentaries would gather up all the footage, put it in a vault, and then crack it open when you're satisfied that you've gotten your story and it's time to edit the story into a 90-minute or two-hour piece. What we've done with Story of America, you can look at some of the footage at youtube.com/storyofamerica or storyofamerica.org, is for the past 18 months nearly, we've traveled to many states. Early on, we went to Newtown, Connecticut after the massacre there. We visited Detroit. We spent a lot of time in Alabama, a lot of time in Virginia and North Carolina. And when we found something really interesting, we shared it with the public right away. And this allowed us to get feedback from you. Sometimes you helped to point us in another story direction. Sometimes people who we've met over the internet became part of our story. And then eventually we do make a 90-minute film. And that is still very much in the works, and we're not sure when that's going to be done. A lot of what we did over the past 18 months was in North Carolina, having to do with the Moral Monday movement. And the most recent, very interesting story, it's very much part of the Coffee Party story, is about the hospital in Belhaven, North Carolina. The leader of the NAACP in North Carolina, Reverend Dr. William Barber, traveled to Belhaven several times toward the end of last year and the beginning of this year to try to work with the local Republican mayor, Adam O'Neill, to convince a hospital corporation that had recently purchased a 60-some-year-old community hospital not to then close it down for business reasons. The business reasons were sound, many said, but when you're talking about health care, when you're talking about people's access to emergency services, many argued, including this Republican mayor and Reverend Dr. William Barber, that other factors such as human life should also be considered. And long story short, although you can look at it at storyofamerica.org/Belhaven1, B-E-L-H-A-V-E-N, the number one, the combination of the NAACP and these conservative Republicans who cared very much about the community and some videos that we did that raised awareness ended up leading to a different outcome, and the hospital will survive. That basically came to an end this past Thursday, so it's not a bad time for Dan Aronson to let me know that he's not doing well a couple hours before the show and have me step in. So I just thought I would share a little bit about what I've been doing, which I just did, and then allow you to call in if you'd like and tell me what I've missed, especially during the last few months when I've been working especially hard. It's a lot of work when It's a lot of work when you're making a movie. It's more work when you're doing an interactive documentary. And it's even more work and more pressure when you realize that people's lives are at stake. And people could die if a different outcome isn't reached in your story. And I think that it was pretty clear to me and to Annabelle that truth was really the only ingredient that was needed to reach the better outcome. And the best chance these people had at the truth revealing itself was when they poured their hearts out to us, when they talked to us. And so finding a way to package that information in the 10 or 12 videos we did about the hospital in Bellhaven, it felt like, well, when you're around Reverend Barber, it feels like a calling. It feels almost like God's will, you know. But it certainly felt like a civic and social responsibility to work as hard as necessary to make sure that the cries of these people, many of them not very wealthy, some of them unemployed, some of them having lived in this coastal North Carolina region for generations, since slavery days, both black and white people. They were worried about their parents and their grandparents and their children and themselves suddenly being thrust into a situation where they're 70 miles from a hospital with emergency services. So it was exhausting. Not to mention, if you've been following us on Facebook, you know, Annabelle decided to adopt 9 dogs, a family of dogs, including 7 puppies, that we saw on the country road out there, the 264, near Bellhaven. All of them had been successfully readopted. So I guess we fostered them. But that was also a stressful time. So anyways, that's what I've been doing, and I wanted to open the phones up for you. I see some people are listening. Hit 1 if you'd like to tell me what you've been doing or what you have to say about what's been going on in our country. I didn't even watch Meet the Press. I was recuperating over the weekend, which means I watched baseball. I did not see Meet the Press. So what's going on in the United States right now? What's going on in the world? I know that the Senate voted to extend emergency unemployment benefits. I think the vote was 59 yays and something like 37 nays. It now goes to the House of Representatives. What else is in the news? There's some rumblings from the McCutcheon decision. A lot of talk about that on the Coffee Party pages. So go ahead and hit 1 if you want to say something. If you're just listening, that's cool, but I'm going to run out of things to say soon. let me give out the number if you're listening online. It is 646-929-2495, 646-929-2495, and I will just briefly tell you about the end of the Middle Ground show that I used to do. This was maybe 6 months ago, maybe a little more. You know, Coffee Party has always had this interesting struggle to present ourselves in a way that's civil and transpartisan, respectful of people with different beliefs, of people from different regions with different cultures. But I think in part because of the name Coffee Party, it certainly attracted those people who are most concerned about the influence of the Tea Party, or as many would say, those who purchased the media products that created the Tea Party. And so Coffee Party people definitely tended to, you know, have a certain awareness of the problems of money influencing policy, money influencing elections, money influencing political discourse through quote-unquote news channels and radio networks and other other media conglomerates, newspapers, of course, you know, all being purchased by people who have a perspective that's different, right? I mean, if you are born into wealth, if you really have no other focus other than how to increase the billions of dollars of profit that you have into tens of billions of dollars of profit, I mean, if basically your focus is how to compete with the other oligarchs and not get elbowed out of the profit trough, that is your life, and you don't worry about paying the bills, you don't worry if your kids can afford to go to college, well, that's a perspective. It's a valid perspective. But if you, in the process, buy up all the news channels, buy up all the newspapers, buy up all the radio channels, and create narratives that are strong enough that eventually, when necessary, you can create your own social movement as well, a.k.a. the Tea Party, well, that's dangerous. And it is, it's frustrating, and it's of concern to a lot of really good people on the left. And so when Coffee Party came along, of course, Annabelle Park is the center of that story. And she's a person who ideologically, I think, you know, her perspective is more from the left, but she's also a person who comes from a country, Korea, that was torn apart, literally ripped apart by disagreements over what kind of government they should have. And her family was affected by this. She lost members of her family. She had a member of her family, her grandfather, who was an important intellectual in South Korea, abducted by North Korea, and they never saw him again. And so the kind of rhetoric and the kind of politics and the kind of stance that many in this country use to try to win debates or try to win elections, Annabelle identifies that as the wrong path because it can lead places where we don't want to go. And I would say, although I was born here and I don't have that same concern for the most part, but it is true that our country, but I think it's fair to say that our country's history is shaped more than anything else by the Civil War that we went through and the issues that led to the Civil War and the issues that we've had to deal with since the Civil War, including at first the emancipation and the right to vote for African Americans for a few years until a wave of terrorism installed Jim Crow, and then having to deal with the contradictions of being an apartheid country and still seeing ourselves as the beacon of freedom and hope. And then, of course, the civil rights movement, assassinations and riots, and the Southern Strategy, which reversed the political polarities, made the Republican Party into the party that is angry about civil rights and angry about the federal government doing this and that to protect the rights of minorities instead of the Democratic Party, which it had been for most of our history. So all of those things, I think, shape where we are today. And so I agree with Annabelle that we don't want the Coffee Party, and we certainly don't want our country to be divided by the kind of rhetoric that led to civil wars in both Korea and in the United States. And so there's always been a big part of the Coffee Party that's more about the civility, more about the process, more about respect for people with different views, and demonstrating how the outcomes tend to be better when people work together and put aside those differences. That's been a big part of our team. And it's a big part of who Annabelle is and who I am. But like I said, we also attracted people who were deeply concerned about the media manufacture of the Tea Party and who manufactured them and why and what their vision for America was. That was a deep concern. And so Michael, who is a Republican from New Hampshire, who is conservative on many issues, he and I, we used to model that kind of conversation every Wednesday night on this channel, Coffee Party Radio. But over time, I think that our listenership and even our members of our board of directors have become more interested in, frankly, the Democrats winning the debate. Now, I'm not saying everyone, but I'm saying a lot. And so Michael was barraged by negative comments for his posts on our Facebook page. He was often unhappy with that some of our fellow Coffee Party directors, Michael was on the board of directors with us, would add basically stuff that's kind of like maybe Ed Schultz would say, except for without the without a staff to help proofread. So it was stuff that was angry and very liberal and very accusatory toward conservatives and Republicans. In many ways, exactly what we don't like about the Tea Party, except for coming from the left. And I have to say, I don't like that stuff either. But I'm only one of currently 8 members of the board of directors. I only have one vote. And ultimately, we made a series of decisions that chose to err on the side of allowing people to say whatever they want to say rather than to uphold our values of civility and transpartisanship. And so people like Michael Charney decided to leave. And that's where we kind of are today. I think Coffee Party has mostly been, sorry for the noises here, I'm just trying to go to another room, it might be quieter. Coffee Party has mostly been frozen in time since we had it out and basically decided through a series of votes and actions and non-actions that we were going to be a democracy movement and just be what the sum total of everybody's personal opinion was. And, you know, the truth is that it took a lot of work for me and others who care about transpartisanship and civility to create a coffee party that was inviting and welcoming to conservatives and to even independents who don't like the vitriol that comes from the left or the right when it comes to politics. And that's kind of where Coffee Party is today. We have, you know, some new people who've come in who do believe in the transpartisanship, and that's heartening to me and to others. And we'll see where it goes. But with the standstill that we reached when we realized that, those people who we expected to do things in the way of actions were more interested in basically ratcheting up political rhetoric to attack conservatives and Republicans. And then others who would love to have actions but don't want to necessarily take actions when the Coffee Party brand seems to be moving in that direction. So that's kind of where we've been during the same period that the middle ground show is no longer on the air, and that I've frankly been putting the majority of my time into Story of America, which in many ways is the inheritor of what the Coffee Party was. And again, Story of America talks to people from all political persuasions and I wouldn't say facilitates, but certainly documents, and I guess you could say encourages cooperation between the major parties and between people who have different political views. And what happened in Belhaven, North Carolina, is a good example of that. Okay, so now I've done a longer monologue, but I still don't have anybody who wants to call in. So I'm going to start to wind down and give a number out just in case. One more time, 646-929-2495. This is Press 1 for Democracy. It's Dan Aronson's weekly show, 9 p.m. Eastern every Monday. We also have Lunch with Loudon at 3 p.m. Eastern every Thursday. It's lunchtime on the West Coast where Janine lives at 3 p.m. Eastern. On Saturdays, we have Egberto Ruiz's Politics Done Right at 1 p.m. Eastern. on Sunday. We have Bud Fields. Hold on 1 second. Progressive, that is Tennessee politics, progressive style. Sorry that I don't know that, Bud Fields. Hold on, I'm looking it up. What this show turned out to be is just kind of an update from one of the first people who were ever in the Coffee Party, Eric Parler. I've been working on another project called Story of America. You can look at it at storyofamerica.org. I'm still on the board of directors. I'm actually the president of the board of directors. But like I said, only 1 in 9 votes. So the things that you are seeing and will be seeing are a collective decision, not necessarily mine. And the name of Bud Fields' show is Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, and it's Sundays 3 to 5 Eastern. So I'm going to switch back to Blog Talk Radio for 5 more seconds and see if anybody wants to talk. I do see one. Okay, you're from an 813 area code. You're on Press 1 for Democracy with Eric Byler. How's it going?
I'm doing well, Eric. How are you doing this evening?
Doing great. Doing great.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
My name's Steven. I'm calling from Tampa, Florida. I'm living the dream is what I like to say. Tell you where I sit before I tell you where I stand. I am ideologically a libertarian. I vote pretty consistently Republican based on my their coalition is closer to my values and the Democratic coalition is. I'm not a Tea Party member, but I have a lot of Tea Party friends, and I'm sympathetic to a lot of their causes. Some of them are still a little too hypocritical for what I lay down from a libertarian point of view, so I don't, while we do have some common interests, I don't really align myself or claim to be a Tea Party member. But based on your comments tonight, this is something I've never understood, and you seem like a thoughtful guy, and you seem like maybe you're not going to, call me names or make, just blanket accusations. So what I'm curious about, what I've never been able to understand, is what is so disruptive about the Tea Party to some people on the left. And I just, maybe you can explain that to me, because I don't see what the concern is. As from my perspective, my experience in dealing with these people and having conversations with them is that it's tea means taxed enough already. It's primarily concerned about fiscal problems in America. It's largely concerned about what they perceive as a government that's going beyond what it should do. To which they have a lot of concerns based on other governments throughout the history of the world that have gotten too much power, and maybe they received their power under a great leader, but that power was eventually turned over to a terrible leader who did terrible things. And so their concerns to me seem pretty reasonable. And so I'll just shut up, and maybe you can help me understand what the concern is from the left.
Okay, well, please don't shut up for long. I hope that you can, we can make this a conversation. I'm going to quickly tell you a story about North Carolina, and then maybe you can see it from the same perspective that people from the left see the Tea Party. What happened in North Carolina was that in 2010 and 2012, the Republicans won a majority in both the Senate and the House, and also the governor's mansion, and they began to implement an agenda that is very much about smaller government, lower taxes, cutting social programs, cutting education, reducing the regulation of businesses, the regulations that try to protect us from pollution and all that stuff. They also began to attack, or I shouldn't say attack, but erode voting rights, new laws that had been installed when the Democrats were in power that made it easier for people to vote. And so what happened was is that this coalition of progressive groups led by the NAACP began to protest every Monday, and they basically just stole the show. And the conservatives had a hard time getting their message out. These rallies had thousands of people, and every Monday all the headlines were about the rallies that were being held and the message that the progressive left had to criticize the new administration, which was only really a few months old, and it was just really frustrating to the conservatives. And so they did a rally that was designed to answer the rally, the Moral Monday rallies. They only did it once, but it was called Thankful Tuesday. And the rally was designed to thank the new government for all the things they were doing. And, you know, this is something we can get into in a minute. You know, it was very clear that there are two different North Carolinas and that the Thankful Tuesday North Carolina was one that was much older and almost exclusively white. But that's not why I tell you the story. What was interesting is that when the head of the Republican Party, whose name is Claude Pope, got up to speak, and he's the brother of Art Pope, if you know who that is, who is basically he's the millionaire or maybe billionaire who bankrolled the think tanks and the political ads that built the conservative majority in North Carolina. Anyway, Claude Pope gets up and he says, you know, I would think that after an election where the people came out and they voted for what they wanted, that the Democrats and the liberals would say, well, let's see how we can work together in this new government to make things better for the people, and let's respect what the people voted. But no, you had to start having all of these rallies and denouncing us and saying that you can't work with us because we're just completely too extreme, and it's just really frustrating that you're treating us this way. And I listened to that from behind the camera and said, well, gosh, that's exactly how the progressives felt, you know, on January 20th, 2009, when Barack Obama was sworn into office, and immediately you saw Glenn Beck and the other conservative personalities starting to rally what became the Tea Party. And that year there was this massive rally on the day after the September 11th anniversary. It was the 9/12 rally that was basically designed to create this massive resistance against Barack Obama being the president, and of course the agenda that he ran on. And so I think that a lot of progressives look at the Tea Party with two major complaints. One is that most of that was generated on television and on the radio. And so it wasn't the kind of grassroots organizing that we associate with the civil rights movement or the women's suffrage movement or the labor movement or all the things that progressives like. It was from the stuff we don't like. It's the rich people who control things, creating media products that are then consumed, and then in the consumption is an advertisement to show up at a rally. And then, of course, those same outlets point their cameras at the rallies and say, look at this enormous rally. Doesn't this mean that America rejects the outcome of its own election? And a lot of progressives are saying, no, I don't reject the outcome of the election, but for whatever reason, you're not pointing your camera at me anymore. And so that was the first objection. And I think the other one was, from what they did see of the Tea Party, it seemed as if part of their rejection of the outcome of the election had to do with Barack Obama's race and his funny name and the fact that his father had been a Muslim and all of that. What do you think about that, Stephen?
Well, I'm happy to say that we will definitely certainly find some clarity and even in occasion some agreement. So, I mean, I think working backwards, I guess, yeah, I took offense. You know, and the problem is the rhetoric that's created and put forward by media and by people who have agendas based not on, you know, getting dialogue going or finding any answers, but making sure they have ratings and things like that. I think that's guilty on both sides. I think the media is culpable on both sides. I think those would-be leaders and people supposedly speaking truth to power are culpable on both sides. You know, I got called a lot of things that was weird to me because, you know, everybody talks about Obama. Tea Party came up because of Obama. That's not entirely true. The Tea Party, the sparks for the Tea Party started under George W. Bush's second term. And if we can have a dialogue with someone who is on the conservative or who is a Tea Party member or who is, like myself, a libertarian-leaning conservative, you will not find me championing George Bush at all. You know, what he did and how he expanded government and how he took government into areas that it just simply does not belong into the extremes that he took them, absolutely disagree with it. And so when I joined the Tea Party, Obama hadn't been elected. When I showed up to my first rally, the Tea Party hadn't been elected yet. And so then all of a sudden, then Obama gets the nomination, and everybody, I think, thought it was going to be Hillary's year, and then all of a sudden it became Obama's year. And at the bottom line, I wasn't going to vote for a Democrat regardless. It could have been Hillary, it could have been Obama, it could have been anybody. So from that perspective, I guess it seems to me a little bit disingenuous for the left to attack me and saying, well, I'm racist because I don't like – when I was going to vote for anybody who was on a Democratic ticket. And so that to me, I guess, so I mean, that would be my only comment to that regard. I mean, I guess I can kind of see what you're saying, but from my perspective, it's like you guys could have put up the, you know, Winston Howell III from Gilligan's Island. I mean, you could have put up whatever you wanted to define as the stereotypical quintessential Republican. And if he had a Democrat next to his name, I was going to vote for him because I don't like their platform and their coalition. As far as being against Barack Obama, as soon as he started, this is where I just wish there was some intellectual honesty in the conversation on both sides. Again, I cite both sides for this, but you know, it seems that George W. Bush got no support at all throughout the entire course of his presidency. And I would point to the anti-war movement. I don't think anybody can make a strong argument that's going to say that George W. Bush's policy and Barack Obama's policies are any different. But yet, as soon as Barack Obama was elected to office, the anti-war movement disappeared. So it's like and both sides, just don't misunderstand me, both sides, you want to point it out and say, well, you didn't support the president. Of course I didn't support the president. Of course I want Barack Obama to fail because I don't like his ideas. I think he's wrong. Just like you guys wanted George W. to lose because you disagree with his ideas. And that's a reasonable position that real people can have. It doesn't mean we necessarily have to hate each other, and it's something that both sides do. And as for finally to the idea that the corporations are drumming up support or somehow initiating the Tea Party, okay, I can see you gripe about that. I feel the same way when labor unions, who have a lot of already the established organizations, who have a lot of big money interest in government, who have a lot of undue influence due to how much money they can contribute through lobbyists and things like that. So, I'll say that's what you got. That's what, you know, my side's got. The Koch brothers, if you want to get upset, and your side's got that, or whoever's side. I mean, everybody's got them. Everybody's got the people you forgive me. The point is it just happens on both sides. It happens on both sides. And I know if you're on Blog Talk Radio, if you listen to Southern Sense, or if you were to listen to Southern Sense, and listen to her talk, and hear her speak, she is the founder of a Tea Party somewhere in the South, I believe. I'm not sure exactly where. Mideast, Midwest, I mean, somewhere possibly. I'm not sure. She's not getting any corporate support. She's not getting any financial backing from anybody. The GOP doesn't like her. The corporate interests, in my opinion, don't like the Tea Party. I'm sorry if I'm going off on you here. I'll go ahead and turn the floor back over to you.
You can hear me, right? Okay. They have some second thoughts about the Tea Party now. I think the really powerful moneyed interests. You can hear me, right, Stephen?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I mute my phone.
Okay. So gotcha. But at the time, in 2009, I think that what they were looking at was a pretty stark future without the Tea Party. You had, you know, the changing demographics in America, and the advent of social media, creating this Obama machine, which he had already announced early on. And this is something that Annabelle and I didn't especially like to hear, but he said, we're going to now turn this into sort of a DNC machine, whereas not everybody who got involved in electing Barack Obama in 2008 thought of it as a partisan, you know, fight forever. But anyway, they were looking at these changing demographics, and electoral college is not in their favor. And then, of course, the legacy of the Bush administration, which you talked about. A lot of people who were conservatives, whether fiscal conservatives or maybe they're social conservatives but aren't especially fond of fighting wars for profit, there was a lot of disappointment with the Bush years. I think that most people agreed across the political spectrum that it had been a failure, the second Bush administration. And so what they were looking at is, you know, if Barack Obama manages the stimulus package to somehow pull the economy out of the ditch, and they get another administration similar to Bill Clinton's with tremendous economic growth, just about everybody who's alive and voting would have this 24-year recollection That would be Democrat in the White House, everything goes well. Republican in the White House, everything goes poorly. Democrat in the White House, everything goes well. And if they didn't find some way to reverse that, then it would have been curtains, you know? So in some ways, the Tea Party was, although in the long term, there are a lot of negative impacts for the Republican Party. I think that even the establishment Republicans who have never really been comfortable with the level of anger and somewhat, you know, cultural or racial tinge to what the Tea Party says, they would probably have to admit that if they had found a way to mobilize the portion of America that was most upset with the outcome of the 2008 election, if they hadn't found a way to disrupt the Obama administration's attempt to revitalize the economy, and if they hadn't won in the 2010 election and redistricted the House in a way to basically insulate themselves from the changing electorate, the demographic shift that our country is going through, it would be curtains. I mean, they would basically have to rebuild the Republican, probably reemerge as being to the left of the Democratic Party in order to compete. So this was really the only choice for conservatives, especially, well, not especially, but it was really the only choice for conservatives who saw the Republican Party as the party that could best fight for their ideals. Okay, back over to you, Stephen, and now we have more callers. So I'll let you get a last point in before we bring someone new into the conversation. We'll keep you with us. Okay, Stephen?
Yes, sir, and I appreciate you giving me the time. So I can agree with some of what you're saying. I really discredit the racial aspect to it. I think most of the racial animosity that's on this side of it is from white people who are tired of being told from other white people that because we disagree with them philosophically that we're racists, and in that you basically discredit anything I have to say, any values I might have, any judgments, anything I might have to say is absolutely discredited as soon as you call me a racist. I'm pretty tired of that. I know from a lot of my conservative friends who are black, and yes, there are quite a number of them, and they are some of the most vocal, passionate supporters. If you want to see what I'm talking about, Google Frederick Douglass Republicans. They're tired of being ostracized within their own community and being called Uncle Toms and being called race turners and things like that for the same reason. So, I mean, I don't have any is there ignorance and bigotry? Yeah, and I'll find it for you in any political party you want to go to. You know, but is that endemic or indicative of the entire party? Absolutely not. And I think where you can find those small little pockets, I think if you look at the conservative movement and especially in the Tea Party movement, because the Tea Party doesn't really like the GOP and the GOP doesn't really like the Tea Party. And I agree completely with some things you said. I think the GOP is on its way out the door anyway. We are fighting amongst ourselves over here. So I agree with a lot of what you said, except for the fact that I don't see the racial element to it. It's there, but I don't think it's dominant, and I don't think anybody can prove that it's dominant.
Sure, I don't think it's dominant. Go ahead.
I'm encouraged by conversations like this. I was encouraged by the conversation I had last week. You know, by just being able to have a reasonable conversation. Even though I'm going to say that you and I are probably going to politically disagree about possibly everything, I bet if we were to list our top 10 priorities, they'd square up pretty important, and they'd have to do with our family and our children and our safety and our freedom and being able to live life in an America that represents everybody. And that's what I get encouraged by a conversation like this where you didn't hang up on me as soon as I said I'm a Republican. So I'll sit back and listen to the rest of the show.
Okay, well, we'll probably bring you back on after we've heard from these other two folks, Stephen, but thank you very much. And I just
want to
say, what I did say on this call was that there are people on the progressive side and also the more establishment Republicans who are uncomfortable with the racially or culturally tinged attacks on President Obama that we associate with the Tea Party. And I think that's definitely true, that people are uncomfortable with that. But I don't mean to say that that is indicative of all people or even the majority of people who have participated in the Tea Party. It's a delicate thing. I'm half white and half Asian. I'm usually pretty comfortable in all settings. But when I have documented, I'm a filmmaker also, and when I have documented Tea Party rallies, and early on there was a lot of kind of an anti-immigrant element to it, just because of the...
I would, I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you. I really have to qualify because it's anti-illegal immigrant. Anti-illegal immigrant. That's an important word in front of that a lot of people seem to leave out when we talk about our concerns about border security and illegal immigration.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and there's probably something, an issue we would disagree about. Maybe we can come back to it. But I'm just saying that I, as a person who is, I have to say I'm a person of color because I'm half a person of color, and certainly that makes you a person of color, I think, in this country, but in most places too. And so I have been a little bit uncomfortable myself with the environment that some of these rallies, either officially named Tea Party or sometimes like the Thankful Tuesday, it was much of the same coalition, but certainly for the individual person who happens to be white and then shows up at a rally where everyone else happens to be white, it's not that person's fault. It's certainly not their fault that the rally was organized in such a way that it attracted that audience. It's just what happens is that people end up saying, well, I'm going to choose the coalition with whom I feel most comfortable. And so for a lot of the urban dwellers or the younger generation, people of color or people who have mixed families or that sort of thing, they're just going to, just based on those optics, let alone whatever's written on a sign, and I grant you, they always use the worst-looking signs and the most offensive signs for the media presentation, but even before that, the optics of it is going to cause a good chunk of our country, and it's a growing chunk, to be more comfortable with the progressive coalition. It's not a way of saying I'm not trying to demean or criticize people who participate in the Tea Party, but it's in some ways, I guess you could say, it's just a deficit they have to overcome.
If I can just really quick just to address that final point, that's cool,
yeah.
And I'm with that, how you're looking at that, and I'll leave that to the very articulate and well-spoken homosexual and gay and lesbian transgender Republicans that I am, have conversations with and who I will be highlighting on a program that I do on Blog Talk Radio. So that's fine. I'm comfortable as long as you give us a chance to make an argument. And as long as you give us a chance, and I encourage that on my side of the argument. Like I said, I line up Republican. I'm trying to ask my people to do the same thing. Give us a chance to prove that we are not who you say you are, and give us a chance to find those people within our ranks who fall into those demographics that you say we hate and we're opposed to, and let them make our case for us. And as long as we get that opportunity, hey, let's everybody make their case, and let's everybody make their values and their ideas, and see what rises to the top. So back to you, man.
Steven, real quick, tell me when your show is on.
My next show will be not this Thursday, but the Thursday after that, from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. It is still listed under Politics Conservative on Blog Talk Radio, but I'm about to move it over into politics. It's called Move the Middle, and it's on, if you were to Google or if you were to search Reactionaries Speak, he's kind of got the proprietor of that runs programming Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and I am on every other Thursday. I'll say, you know what, I am set up on the right, and if you go over to that, you're going to hear a lot of diverse opinions, many of which you're going to shake your head at, many of which I shake my head at. But, if you're a missionary, you go to where, you go to where they need the help, and this is my party, this is where my values show me that I line up on the right, and there's some of these people over here that I'm working just as hard to reach them as I feel like I am trying to reach out to reach other people on the other side of the aisle and try to get them to calm down and quit believing the stupid press. I don't believe the lies that they say about me or about them. We shouldn't believe the lies they say about you. We should realize that there's media interest and political interest and all kind of interests that want to keep us from having a conversation and keep us separated. And I digress, man. I'm gonna keep going. So just go to your other callers, brother.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go to a 620 area code, and then I'm going to go to a 727 area code. Steven from Tampa, Florida, who also is a Blog Talk Radio host, has been on with me. This is Press 1 for Democracy. Eric Fowler, guest hosting for Dan Arizin. 620 area code.
Jim, Jack,
you're on
Jack Golding.
Hey, Jack.
How you been? Okay. That guy is a Tea Party man. He makes sense. He might
all right.
be able to deal with that. But okay, but I want to say two things. First of all, Harry Reid. made a great statement exposing the Koch brothers. And the more they are exposed, the more they get to know them, the more you're going to get to hate them. And number two, I want to advocate term limits for the Supreme Court justices. Because the basis for that was J. Edgar Hoover. You go back to the 50s even. I mean, back when I was in college. Now, J. Edgar Hoover was a tyrant. Now, they got the head of FBI is limited to a 10-year term. Supreme Court justices should be limited to a 10 to 15-year term. Think about it. J. Edgar Hoover is the basis for my feelings about that.
Mm-hmm.
We should strengthen the term limits, and that's pretty much what I have to say.
Okay, well, thank you, Jack. Thank you. I'm gonna. Why don't you press one again right now, so your hand will be down, and then if you want to say something later in the show, just press one again, and you'll come back up. I'm going to see if our 72. Okay, thank you, Jack. He calls from Kansas just about every week. We have a 727 area code. You had your hand up earlier. You might have meant to put it down, but I'm just going to call on you right now because it may be that you hit one a second time because you were eager to come on the show. So 727 area code, you're on the air. I hope I didn't make a mistake by calling on you.
I hope I didn't make a mistake.
you didn't. Let me know your name and where you're calling from.
Mary Ann, and I'm actually in the Tampa Bay area as well.
Whoa, crazy. Okay, how are you doing, Mary Ann? Thanks for calling in.
Good.
That is really weird.
I know, yeah. And I really enjoyed it. I'm definitely a progressive, liberal, guilty, but I really enjoyed listening to Stephen tonight, and I'm looking forward to listening to his radio show as well. I hope he calls in again to this to Coffee Party Radio. He's definitely an addition.
Do you want to respond to that, Stephen?
Well, I mean, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And my Move the Middle is my radio program and the organization I'm trying to create. And at this point, it's really come to quickly present itself to me in the past couple of months, and right now I'm just like right at the beginning of it. I'm very excited about it. I feel like I've always been somewhat politically active. It started out 20 years ago. I had one issue, and it was my big issue. And over the course of time, and over the course of conversation, I realized that my issue and my desire for my particular rights and freedoms can really be everybody's. I mean, everybody's. But we've gotten to this point where we divide it. One of my catchphrases is there is no pie. And it's this idea that we've gotten, it seems, in society where we think that there's a certain amount of rights and there's a certain amount of freedoms, and now we're fighting against each other. And we're fighting, saying, oh, I got to have my freedom and this and that and other thing, and we got to change that. And reasonable people, I mean, you and I could disagree on absolutely everything. But if we can respect that about each other, though, and just agree that, you know what, I think you're absolutely crazy and you think I've made every bad decision, but we can look for a couple of key things that are important. Like, I campaign finance reform, it sounded like it's going to ring some bells on the coffee party. That's one that people on the right can get behind. Let's find a goal. Let's achieve victory with it. Let's all come together and act like adults. And then those politicians that really are playing that same game of keeping us divided, then they have to pay attention, because then we're working together. And that's all what I'm pushing. I don't care what brings you to the table. As long as you come to the table and you say, I want to make America better, I want to secure my rights by defending yours, and I respect our differences, and through that we can be stronger, because then we're covering all the bases. Everybody's looking at freedom from their particular angle, and we all disagree with everybody, but we all respect that, hey, we have one life. I start to go up on a rant, so I digress.
No. That's exactly what I think that the coffee party is all about, exactly what you're saying. And that's why
and if I might
just say, you're a terrific addition. You're a terrific addition, and I hope you call in a lot.
Well, and if I might just say one thing, as I have been developing my game plan for going forward and have been trying to figure out how I'm going to, you know, reach these goals that I have, one of the things that is just inherent to what I have to do is to find groups locally that I can reach across the aisle to, and so that we, because all politics is local, so it's great to have this national platform, but we have to connect locally. I've got some plans to do that, but one of the things I was already thinking is the fact that I'm going to find, like, some, you know, Women for Democracy for Obama or some group like that, because I don't know how it, I'm starting to assume things based on our side of the aisle. On our side of the aisle, women are really driving the movement, and women are some of the most reasonable. So I was going to start trying to find some reasonable women, and so I would love to talk to you a little bit more on my next program or later, because women, so I'm assuming that women are driving the argument based on the same passions, concern for their children, concern for the future, and they're probably more reasonable. Women, strange fact here, just an aside, women have caught up in almost every, or are making gains in every single demographic to men except for crime. Women have not closed the gap in crime. And that, to me, just says something fundamental about women, that when they have the opportunity, and even as opportunities present themselves to be evil or to do wrong, they're more inclined not to. So that's why I'm going to start with reasonable women. You sound like one, and thank you very much for your compliments. And I get excited because it seems like I'm making success, and hopefully we can all come together and be successful.
I think so.
Well, certainly you're welcome, Stephen, to be part of this community. We really do. I don't know if you heard my introduction, but I'm one of the people in Coffee Party who really values conservative voices. It's also getting us excited to hear from you. So I got your number from you calling in, and I'll contact you. And there's other ways that you can participate. We do more than Blog Talk Radio, and other ways that you can be part of our conversation and really enrich it. So I thank you for that. Let me ask if either one of you want to respond to the 2 points that Jack made. One of them was that, and I mentioned this very briefly, there was a New York Times article that said that the Democratic Party is going to try to apply the Bain Capital strategy to the Koch brothers. I saw it, I don't know if this is related, but I saw an argument being made in, I think it was the Atlantic magazine, I might be wrong, that because these powerful special interests that, especially these individuals that are spending untold amounts of money to try to influence election results, not just at the national level or even the Senate level, but all the way down, although in North Carolina, the Koch brothers are spending money for school board. So if these people are essentially more influential than any individual politician, except for perhaps the president, more influential than any senator, I think, for sure, then perhaps they should be given the same amount of scrutiny by the press as, say, maybe Jay Rockefeller or Edward Doheny, the oligarchs who manipulated our political process a century ago. I think it was J.P. Morgan, was an oilman, right? Morgan Oil. Maybe I'm confusing him with a banker, or maybe it's the same guy. But these guys, Morgan and Doheny, bought the White House in 1920. They bought the president. That term, the smoke-filled room, that comes from the 1920 Republican National Convention, where they bought enough delegates to ensure that neither of the top two delegate winners, presidential candidates, could win. And so the third choice they basically engineered was Warren G. Harding, and in return, Warren G. Harding gave them Secretary of Interior. They were able to put their own person in the Secretary of Interior. This is because they wanted the Navy oil fields, known as the Teapot oil fields, and it led to the Teapot Dome scandal and really, in a lot of ways, the downfall of Harding and his administration. Harding died in office, and some say he was poisoned. But in any case, read the Teapot Dome scandal. It's a great book. That's why I know about this. But the person who wrote the Atlantic article was saying, can you name any senator, can you name one senator that served between the Civil War and the Great Depression? But you can't. You probably can't, right? But you can name all of the oligarchs who shaped American history during that time, and I just named three. Well, what the article is saying is, well, we have oligarchs today that are having similar impact that we had during the Gilded Age. And so shouldn't the press be focusing on those people in the same way that they did? There was a lot of fascination with the oligarchs of those days. Well, here comes the Democratic Party with, coincidence or not, almost exactly the same argument, except for they're doing it in political ads. And so I saw an ad today that was targeting the Koch brothers in the very same way. I bet you it was done by the same people who did the Bain Capital ads. You know, they come into our state, they buy up the factory, then they lay everybody off, and they pollute our water. And we don't want them to come into our state and telling us who to vote for after they did that. So I want to see if Marianne or Stephen wanted to respond. I just expanded a lot on what Jack said. And then I'll introduce Jack's other issue after you guys get a chance to respond. Let me go to Marianne, ladies first, and then Stephen. Marianne, what do you have to say about that? Is that fair game? Should they be going after the Koch brothers?
I think so, but I really would like to hear Stephen's take on that. Because, I mean, I think it seems obvious what you said, but I would like to hear his thoughts on that.
You know, I guess this is part of the game that, are you still with me?
Oh, yeah, we got you.
Okay, apologize for that, my phone beeped. That's kind of the part of the game that I try to just be rational about, and your caller spoke about the Koch brothers. You know, if you look at overall political spending, they rank like 52nd or 53rd. They're very low down on the list. And if you look at the top 10, like 9 out of the top 10 go to Democratic parties. And so to me, it's like you say Koch, I say Soros. You say this group, I say that group. There's the guy whoever's the big money donor right now that's currently pushing global climate change initiatives, and he's spending millions of dollars in order to do it. And so your guys spend money, and we spend money. And I don't understand the argument that says that somehow the Koch brothers, who have not violated any laws, who have simply been very successful capitalists, who have made a whole lot of money and have made a whole lot of money for other people, and live in a quasi free market that's not really a free market, it never has been, that's governed by regulations and laws that are put in place by politicians. Who are going to make decisions that are going to drastically affect their business and how they make money and how they choose to do, you know, just simply to do business. Why should they not have a voice to be able to talk to their concerns about policies that are going to affect their business if they're not, again, they're not violating any laws, they haven't broken any laws?
Marianne, but it seems to me like their money, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe I'm reading too many liberal. It seems like they're doing much more destruction to our society than George Soros.
Of course.
I mean, anti-regulation, and I don't know. I don't agree with that, Stephen.
Okay. Would you agree with the statement that we have nothing close to a free market, at least? Would you agree with the statement that we could deregulate literally thousands of laws that deal directly with business regulations, and we could still have thousands of laws on the book to regulate? Would you agree that regulations violate each other and conflict with each other? And I don't mean to be putting you on the spot, but I'm just saying, you know, here's an example of a tit for tat, and this is the only way I know how to solve it, because if we carry on these conversations about who's spending the money, you think the Koch brothers is evil and they're degrading society. I think they're speaking towards freedom and choice. I think what they're doing is combating people like Soros and things like that. And so the tit for tat then is if you look at Jefferson County in Colorado, which is my home state, and it recently had a turnover. There was a slate of legislators who ran as a slate, three of them, to become a minority or a majority of the school board. They ran. They were elected by the citizenry. They were duly elected. Immediately, within the next week, the National Education Association starts dumping millions of dollars in ad campaigns trying to undermine them, already prepping for the next election, which they lost again. Okay, so it's like people, you know, everybody does it. The problem to me is, why are people spending so much money to impress people or to dictate government? It seems to me that government maybe has too much influence in too many areas. Because if government had less influence and less dictating of what we did, then we wouldn't have these huge money interests who would be able to buy government, who would be able to make laws, to be able to tell us what we're going to do and how we're going to live. So, I mean, in another example, George Soros spent billions of dollars, not billions, excuse me, millions of dollars trying to defeat George Bush. It didn't win. So even though he's spending all this money, it really doesn't make an influence. It's not this positive anyway. It does make an influence. It's not this positive. You have to have enough money to even be in the game. But beyond that, if you find a way to get your message out, then money isn't the determining factor. Same to that. Who was the the Tea Party chick who, I'm sorry, I don't mean to say chick in a derogatory manner, the Tea Party lady who ran against Harry Reid, and she got her money from wrestling, I think, or she was married to somebody who was a wrestler, and she spent millions of dollars of her own money, and she lost. Okay, so if we want to have a conversation.
That's two different people. Sharon Angle ran against Harry Reid, and then the wife of the wrestling mogul was Linda McMahon, who was a candidate in Connecticut.
Neither one of them lost, though, right? I mean, neither one of them won.
Yeah, they both lost for different
reasons.
They
both lost.
Yeah.
For different reasons, but they both spent a whole lot of their own money. And if you look through history, yes, it makes it. So if, you know, I can't do the Koch brothers are evil, the Soros thing is evil thing. If you want to talk about money in politics, yeah, it's bad. Let's get it out. But if you're going to start telling me that the people, but as soon as you say they're trying to destroy society, I like to say they're trying to destroy society as I see it. Because that's, you know. You sin different than me. That's what our problem is. All right, but I'm not going to begrudge you for that, and I hope you're not going to begrudge me for that. You know, as long as, you know, but can we agree that politics and there's too much money wrapped up in politics? Because I'm on board with that.
Yeah. I don't think anybody could disagree with that.
It's hard to disagree with that, but at the same time, one of the things that we've encountered is that the divide and conquer approach has been so successful in this country. And I'm not trying to say that we're bad. I'm not even trying to say the people who've used the tactics are bad. It's just a fact that because we were born as a country declaring a right to self-governance and a right to individual freedom, and yet holding an entire population of people as slaves, and it was race that determined who was a slave and who was a master, because that was our original sin, we're always going to be susceptible to divide and conquer, conquer tactics. And what we've discovered in traveling the country is that the scars of slavery, the scars of the Civil War, the scars of the vicious, violent wave that ended the right to vote for black people in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s, the scars of Jim Crow, the scars of the Civil Rights Movement, all of these things are still haunting us to the degree that there's enough division in this country. We have met many people who would prefer if the oligarchs ruled. They would prefer if the wealthy people determine the outcome of our elections, because they just don't trust their neighbors. They don't trust their fellow Americans who are different from them in whatever reason that they've been made to feel is more important than the notion of self-governance. They don't trust those people so much that they would prefer another form of government to democracy. They would prefer plutocracy because plutocracy helps my side win over their side. So there's definitely an interest in fighting money in politics, but there's a degree to which I think some would say I prefer the money to an election that is solely in the hands of the people, because that would mean the people who I don't like and who don't like me, those people are going to win.
It doesn't sound like America, Eric.
It's a terribly depressing point of view. A terribly depressing point of view.
It just doesn't sound like our country, though.
We covered in the North Carolina election law changes, and there are a lot of people who basically feel that way. And they're not bad people. It's just that that's how they've come to understand politics, right? It's our side versus your side. And if we can decrease turnout among these populations, it helps our side, it hurts your side, and that's just what we're doing, you know? So anyways, I want to change the subject a little bit and try to go deeper right now. So, Stephen, I wanted to ask you, what do you see as the philosophical and political roots of strain of libertarianism that is against the regulations that people like Marianne and I feel are important to protect consumers, protect our environment, the water we drink, the air we breathe. What would you say is the root? I would hope that you could go back somewhere, you know, beyond the recent American history, but I'm talking like founding root for that body of political thought.
No, I can't do that. I will. I am a stay-at-home father, and in the evenings I sling pizzas. And I can speak to that question as to what I know of it, but I don't know if I could give you the broader context of capital L libertarianism and where it changed. I can tell you why I was a libertarian and moved away from it, and I can tell you what I feel is the major problem with reaching libertarians.
Okay.
And that's simply that libertarians sit in a unique position where they can chastise the fiscal policies of the right, or excuse me, the fiscal policies of the left and the social policies of the right. And they can, throughout history, just point to examples of here where our policies were not followed, and look what happened. Look at fascism. Look at communism. Look at all these dictatorships. Look at what has happened to crony capitalism in America. That's because you're not adhering to our values, and you're not adhering to what we believe. And unfortunately, they are right. You know, and that's I honestly believe that if everyone adhered to the capital L Libertarian Party philosophy, we would probably all get along great, and everything would be much, much better. But what they don't appreciate is that, one, not everybody agrees with them, and two, not everybody is up for the rigors of libertarianism. So where you would want regulation and some type of overarching industry or agency that's going to make sure products are safe and that you know, things being put to the public are safe, the stingent libertarian would say, well, no, sir, because you are infringing on my rights, and if I choose to do something that I want to do and you haven't signed off on it, I don't care. I'm willing to take that risk, because we should all be willing to take that risk, because therein lies our rights and our freedom. And they pound their chest, and they feel great about themselves. And then they go out and they get 1/3 of 1% of a vote in a general election. So that's their problem, is they're right, but nobody cares. Nobody cares. We all have our own little specific ways that we look at things. You know, I am inspired by many libertarian ideas, but I don't want the rigors that would be involved in a true libertarian lifestyle, a true libertarian form of democracy. I like certain comforts. I like that we can organize and use common sense and say, hey, these guys are selling stuff that we're going to give to our kids. How about we keep an eye on that? That, to me, is a reasonable position. You know, but libertarians, unfortunately, and then they're terrible communicators, because, and this is my experience, and I, you know, I would love to be corrected, but the phrases I hear most from libertarians are, you're just not educated enough, and you're part of the problem. You know, I got nowhere to go. I've got nowhere to go with that. I mean, that's the same for any ideology. As soon as somebody tells me, you know what, you're just stupid, and all you do is listen to Fox News, and you're just a corporate chauffeur, you know, okay, I've got, you know, what am I going to say to you? You don't care, you know, you don't care about me anyway, so whatever. So that's where libertarians fail. If they would be more pragmatic and pick some sides and bring some of their good arguments and compromise a little bit the way we have to, our form of government favors big tents. It favors a two-party system because it favors large coalitions. So we don't want, you know, groups of people, in theory, angling for their own little, again, piece of the pie. We want a large coalition. We want large groups of people who have to compromise so that they can come together in order to get the, you know, control of Congress, in order to get enough Electoral College votes. And libertarians, I wish they would choose either side. You know, get in with the Democrats. I see vast area for improvement down the Democratic Party from my perspective. Go over there and make an influence. Come over to our side and make a difference. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that's my take.
Well, Marianne, let me ask you, what's wrong with the argument that a company that produces coal should have the freedom to dispose of their coal ash or other chemicals that are used to spray on coal in the river? What's the public argument against that private interest?
Well, I don't know if I was going to be speaking from Stephen's perspective.
Yours. But what's the argument against that argument? What's the argument against someone saying we should have the right to pollute?
I'm going to be pretty simple about it. It's just wrong.
Okay, morally it's wrong.
That's all I have.
I wish I could be as succinct and on point as that answer was. I would have taken 15 minutes to explain that. You nailed it, because it's wrong. There are, believe it or not, some answers that are really just that simple.
That's interesting. Okay. Well, okay. So where I was going with it is that, and this is where there's a misunderstanding, I think, maybe that might be illuminating for you. I think on the left, people interpret libertarianism through two lenses. One is the Koch brothers' interest. And that is, they want lower taxes and they want to be free to pollute. And the reason why they want to be free to pollute is it's very expensive to clean up after the mess or to clean up the process so it makes less mess. And they would prefer that the public pay for that. They prefer that we, the taxpayers, are the ones who clean up the river or clean up the water or clean up the air or deal with climate change and all of that. It's just simply more lucrative for them, and they have a right to advocate for that position. But we also have a right to make laws, and we have a right to ask that they be enforced. And the real contest that we're seeing right now, at least on that side of the argument, is over whether the government should have the right to make laws that they can ask even the most wealthy and powerful corporations and individuals to follow as well. I think we, at the beginning of this country, came to an understanding that the government should have the right to make laws in terms of personal property and violence and murder and all that. And I think we agreed to live with basically a social covenant that certain things, if we decide as it should be against the law, we have a right to expect that those laws be enforced. But where libertarianism has been most effective, for whatever reason, I think it might have to do with political spending, is in the argument that, okay, yes, there should be laws that govern whether you can murder somebody or steal their stuff, but not laws that govern how much a corporation or a factory can pollute. Because there's no direct harm when they pollute. It's, you know, it takes science to prove that, you know, the carcinogens in the water, you know, there's all this stuff that's very iffy. And by the way, we could hire scientists that will prove the opposite.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll go along with you're not supposed to murder and all. But when you try to tell us that we can't put our coal ash in the water, well, that's stepping over the line. You know, and I think that's, in large part, that's where the real argument is today, is whether the government should, can, has the right to, constitutionally, has the right to regulate the ways in which industries use our natural resources and impact our environment.
I want to hear what Stephen has to say to that.
I you know, agree completely. And I think that, you know, I'm surprised to hear you ascribing that particular notion to libertarianism. I've just never heard it presented that way, but I think it makes sense. I would describe that more to like a pure capitalist would feel that way also, and I don't think so. Maybe that just have shared interests there, but I think that's absolutely right. I mean, if we all have a shared interest in certain things in our community, we all have a shared concern over our health and safety, and to simply say, well, I have a freedom to, you know, there's an argument to me, it just goes back to, you know, I have the right to swing my fist as far as, it extends as far as your nose. And, well, as soon as you're polluting my water and you're destroying the environment, you know, this, you're punching my nose. You're punching me in the nose, you're punching my kids in my nose, you're punching my unborn and unbegotten kids in the nose. So it's completely reasonable to expect that we should expect people to maintain clean safety standards and adhere to laws and regulations. And I think to that, though, I think we need to make sure that we have very clear and concise laws and regulations that cannot be bought their way out of, cannot be bribed their way out of, cannot be political donation their way out of. And I think they need to be consistent and without you know, people like to use the term loophole. I hate the term loophole. It's not a loophole. It was designed in the law, probably. Whatever it is that they're getting away with, whatever my gripe is, it's not like they found some sneaky little, no, they wrote it in there. So let's make sure we have laws that are worth respecting. And that's one of the problems. I think just now we have too many laws that everybody violates the law so many times a day. Businesses will do that too, which breeds contempt for the law, and pretty soon you're buying the law and you're trying to make shady deals. We have to account for human nature, in my opinion. So it seems reasonable to regulate.
Okay. Now, we had some new callers. I'm going to keep you guys on, though. And so mute your own phones. And I'm going to bring on 518 and then 620. 518 area code, you were holding longer. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, and what you'd like to add to our conversation.
Yeah, Joe Pomponio in Albany, New York.
Hey, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. Marianne, are you?
It's me. I'm from I am actually originally from Albany, New York, and Joe and I know each other only just through coffee party.
Yeah. I'm really taken with Stephen. I really, really am. He's hit on a lot of points that have come to light to me over the past year. And Stephen, if you're there and listening, there's a book. It's called Extortion. It was written by Peter Schweizer. Okay? Now, with regard to our government, and you were saying about the laws and the regulations, okay, you hit on something that is absolutely correct. Those laws and regulations, regardless of which political spectrum put them there, are used by the people that are elected to gain jobs for family members, to gain contributions. The book illustrates it perfectly. Okay? With regard to big money, here's an area I might take a little disagreement with you on, particularly with the Koch brothers. The FEC, okay, reports through their tributaries, People for Progress, I don't know all their different organizations. When you add all that up, it dwarfs what the common unions or normal citizens contribute to politics. It literally dwarfs them. They put $3 million into a place, Iron County, Wisconsin, population of 2,000 people. $3 million, okay, because they want the ore rights for that area. Right? It's been documented. So, you know, I mean, they're out for something mainly themselves. They want the pipeline. They own the Tar Heels mines in Canada. So, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear-cut what they want. But, you know, with respect to you, I will say this. There are other players, okay, and it's really a worldwide thing. Most of them are multinationals, and the money is kept offshore. Now, if we had a perfect environment, if individuals on either side of the fence, if I can use that term, were actually interested in the citizens, the money wouldn't be in offshore accounts, all right? You don't need unions to demand. You don't need laws to demand or regulate that employment and jobs be created. They have that power themselves. But either side of the aisle won't do it. Now, with regard to children on our future, I'm an old guy. My kids are like in their early 40s and late 30s. My grandchildren are. Technology, together with offshoring, is a cutting edge nobody looks at. They want to enhance education and make the younger people more apt to get jobs. In a few years, okay, robotics are going to have machines that can see. When that happens, all right, jobs are going to disappear. And if those machines are made overseas at a lower cost, they're going to come on the scene a lot quicker. So, I mean, long term, with our national debt, okay, with our overall national debt, I'm just talking about the yearly one, we have serious problems that have to be faced. And, you know, I honestly don't know which way we're going to go. But I do know this, money and politics is the root that's going to destroy it all. Because if they can manipulate and use that money to gain power of our government, then they have power over us. And I've just downloaded the FEC rules for campaign contributions. I have yet to read it all. Off the top of my head, what I can remember is you're running for office. Well, your campaign can pay you a matching salary for the office that you're running for. So if I want a guy to run, okay, and he's got some charisma, okay, I can give him a campaign where he could start out right away as soon as he's running, making $178,000 a year. That's just one perk. There's a whole list of them. That's the danger to opening floodgates of money that so far I've been able to find. And there's more there. You know. And, Stephen, I want to know, you know, you are inspiring, if I must say, and you are an excellent speaker. So, you know, could you, I guess, expound or just kind of, you know, give me some feedback on what I've said?
I'd be happy to, and again, I appreciate your kind words. As I said earlier, I'm really at, you know, this is the second show I've called into, and this is the second time I've called into the same show because I got some good feedback last time. And so I really appreciate, you know, you guys coming out and giving me some words of encouragement because I am just trying to get traction on it. But I can certainly speak to that. Again, you bring up the Koch brothers, and you will want to cite sources that say they're more destructive and they have a bigger influence.
No, hold on.
Allow me, sir. If I could, sir, I don't mean to interrupt you, and I certainly don't mean to put words in your mouth. But if you could let me finish,
sure.
I think you'll see what I'm saying. So no problem. And you're right to correct me, but I'm not trying to. I'm just saying, allowing for the fact that you have whatever objection you have to the Koch brothers, and I will take you at your face value. And all I can say is, for me, I look at the fact that again they rank, mid 50s. On the overall donations. Most donations go to Democrats. The single largest political contributor is the National Education Association, goes over 95% to Democrats, and that's just on the national level. So then again, that's my little tit for tat. That's my little, you've got your gripe, I've got my gripe. You think they're doing great work, I disagree. Okay, but that's my little tit. Okay, so, but I'd like to go a step further, and I'll say, you know what, I agree with you fundamentally, and let's get all the money out then. You're right. I agree with you. I will concede every fact you say about the Koch brothers. Let's get their money out. But let's get Soros' money out.
Right.
Let's get everybody's money out. Let's put a limit on it.
Yeah.
Let's track the money. I don't
care
who wants to give to political parties, but let's know exactly how much. And let's make sure everybody's got the fair game. Because in this society, the Supreme Court has decided that money equals free speech. We can have great discussions. We can have great debates about whether or not that's the case. But fundamentally, if you get enough signatures from the people, then it's not a freedom of speech thing anymore. Now we're in the game of politics. Now we're in the game of ideas. And money shouldn't equal influence, even though, as I said earlier, it's not this positive. It shouldn't. So, you know, I tried really hard to like Barack Obama. I was really hoping he was going to stick to his pledge of just keeping matching funds. And I was upset when he did that. I'm going to put that caveat to whoever I endorse coming up. And I'm going to look for that from other politicians because, in theory, they're our leaders. In theory, they're supposed to be finding the way to bring us together. So I'm going to be looking to them to make that. And so I agree absolutely with you, and let's find ways that we can work together in our communities and in our parties respectively, you and the Democratic Party or whatever party you believe, me and the Republican Party, and let's get all the money out of it.
And I
will check out that book by Peter Schweitzer. I've had that book recommended to me several times.
It is excellent. And, you know, for the record, I'm an independent, okay? My main problem, not per se with you, you sound like you're in the right corner. We can have our differences. But I feel if we elect a representative, he is our voice in government, okay? I'm not his employee. Up here in the North, you know, too many people are of the mind that, well, you know, he's there, he's on his own, and whatever happens, happens. And, you know, you can't be that way and expect the government to respond accordingly, whichever side of the fence it is. You know, the word compromise seems to have gone out the window. And I'm not going to point fingers at who's to blame. I do know, mainly based on this last book, Extortion, I've read several, but mainly based on that, it's a game. And you have organizations that write the laws, then give them to the representative staff who polishes them up, then gives them to the representative to become law. And you're the citizen, and it's like all of a sudden it's something you didn't want, you didn't ask for, okay, but it's there. And in regard to campaign contributions and corporations, corporations are not necessarily bad guys with the regulations that are in place, okay? One side goes, well, I'm going to make it worse. The other guy goes, I'm going to make it better. Then they start hitting up the corporations, all right, for either less regulation or more influence for me to change my mind. That's the core of this book. This is how they make money. And what the Supreme Court did is they just opened the floodgates, right? And the very businesses, okay, that purportedly support the status quo, the 1%, whichever way you want to look at it, are the ones that are going to get burned financially. Now, you know, I mean, economically, they may be able to get something out of it. That's kind of the way government works, as long as neither side gets everything. Now,
mm-hmm.
My piece is over. I turn the call back to you.
Thanks, Joe. So it looks like Jack has called back in and wants to add to the conversation. Jack,
okay.
Jack from Kansas, go ahead.
Yeah, Kansas and Oklahoma. One of the reddest part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are they going to say? I was going to say, talking about race, I believe that exceptions screw up, kill the rule. And I'll tell you a few black racists, like 999 guy, whatever his name is. What is his name?
I'm going to look it up. He ran for president.
Guy owned a big pizza place. Okay.
Herman Cain.
Yeah, okay, that's one. And you got, for the Supreme Court, you got Justice Thomas, who is the most reactionary of the people on the Supreme Court.
Wait, hold on, Jack. Are you saying
why a four-term limit for the Supreme Court? Now, I feel a person pollutes the coal industry, for example, West Virginia and those guys. The guy Manchin, very similar to the guy Manchin, the governor of West Virginia, Manchin or something like that. Now he boasts about it, and he that kills people. Where are you gonna spread the disease among people, Monsanto and all that, with his GMOs. That's where you need regulation, because it's where it's going to affect the health of people, where it's going to kill people. Why you do need environmental regulation, because And environmental rules. That's not my big spiel, because it's going to affect the health of people. It's going to kill people. Colds kill people. That's where you need regulation. And government is not all bad. Now I would suggest this thing, how you feel about it, Mr. Stevens.
Okay.
As they keep these number twos and number threes, these people are helping the senators and congressmen busy, You go line by line which regulation is good and which regulation is bad. You go, you just take out the regulations that are no good, they're going to be harmful, but there are some that are good.
Okay. Thank you for that insight. I think that in some ways he's crystallized it all for us. Thank you, Jack. I don't think anyone on this call is going to say, or the show is going to say, all government is bad or all laws are bad or all regulations are bad. What we need to do is make sure that laws and regulations and that government are exercised in the way that they were intended, and that is to represent the collective will of the people. And that's probably why everybody who's been on this show would agree that having our government and its policies and its laws and its regulations written by corporate entities who have a focus that is, for the most part, very different than the focus of people, and that is to maximize their international profit margin, you know, profiteering, to have them make our laws is bad. And so, therefore, to have the only real, you know, the most important voice that the people have, our elections, to have our elections flooded by money that represents those interests is bad. So we're probably all on the same page there. Did you hear anything, Stephen, that you disagreed with from Jack just now?
Not necessarily. You know, working backwards, I agree completely with this idea that there are a lot of areas in government regulations that we need to just go through and find the good ones and find the bad ones and find the ones that conflict and find the ones that are outdated and find the ones that are redundant and we're wasting money on and get rid of it. I think absolutely that's the right idea. GMOs, I know of good that comes from GMOs, and I don't like to throw a blanket or evil statement behind anybody and GMOs have saved, have fed millions of people around the world in harsh environments. And so saying, and if you want to make that value judgment and say they're going to kill us and they're wrong, that's great. If you want to make an argument that they're trying to corner a market and they're trying to limit other avenues and they're trying to do unethical business practices, I'm right there with you. I'll stand right next to you with that one. I completely disagree with that. I want you know, freedom and free trade everywhere. So, and then finally, and maybe I wasn't picking up what he was laying down, but it seemed to me that he was suggesting there was some, you know, some token minorities in the conservative movement in the Republican Party. I would say, and I'll list a bunch of people that you're probably going to hate, but I'll list Alan West, obviously Herman Cain, Dr. Ben Carson, Mia Love, Bobby Jindal. And if you don't like the party, then go to Blog Talk Radio and turn over to the conservative politics, and you'll find G-Ski Rocks, the hip-hop conservative. You'll find Black by Color Only by Vincent Brown, and you'll find, and then call them up. And if you have assertions or you have beliefs about them, call them up and be respectful, and they'll be respectful for you. And if you think they're just whatever you want to think they are, and if that's all you're going to think, then don't call them. But if you want to challenge them on some things and listen to their arguments, then you know, we're, you know, I one of the things I noticed about the convention, the last convention, it's like every time I watched MSNBC or CNN, they only showed the white speakers. We had so many minority speakers. We had so many women speakers. We have such a diversity over here on the conservative side of it that I just, you know, and so whatever. So those are my thoughts. But, you know, again, we can find common ground on that. And if you want to disagree about the makeup of the GOP, that's fine. We can agree to disagree. Meanwhile, yeah, let's go straighten out the government. Let's get on board, buddy.
Okay. Well, let me just comment on that, because I did sort of hear that too. He mentioned two black conservatives, and I thought he used the word racist before that. And this is not to take Jack to task, but here, this is how I analyze this, okay? It's a very effective political tactic to paint the Republican Party as white, male, racist, Southern, and all these things, which are basically stereotypes and generalizations, which I might point out progressives don't like to hear when they're pointed at immigrants or women or gays or any people of color. But in any case, I think part of the reason why liberals are frustrated by black conservatives or people like Bobby Jindal, the governor of South Carolina as well, I can't remember her name. Do you know it, Stephen? Okay, don't worry about it.
I'm here. I just had it.
Oh, okay. You don't know her either? Okay. But Haley? Okay. Anyways, part of the reasons why progressives get frustrated by those people is that it takes away the easiest and really the laziest way of saying, there's no way I have to even think about listening to the conservative point of view, and neither should anybody else. And so my contribution to the conversation is, don't listen to those people, white, southern, male, racist, whatever, generalization, and therefore don't look any further, don't think anymore. And I think this is a tactic we see on the right and the left. And, you know, on the right, you'll hear things like that. Well, that's socialist and that's communist and Hitler and whatever. You know, they'll come up with their own things. Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States. They'll come up with their own shorthand for saying, don't even bother thinking about how you're going
to. If I have to listen, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you just touched on something. If I have to listen to one more rant about multi-layer PDFs, I'm going to take my own life, possibly. You didn't even touch on some of the arguments that I deal with on the right.
Yeah.
You haven't even touched some of the. It is so obnoxious, especially, and I so appreciate what you're saying, just to know that you're wherever you're at, and some of the people saying, you know what, come on, guys, let's just knock this off. But absolutely, some of the things that go on the right, it's like, you know, yeah, that's my cousin, that's my family over there. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Let's go talk over here.
Mm-hmm. I have members of my family as well who are part of that right-wing conversation and believers. And here's the thing, is that if you have members of your family, then you know something that maybe a lot of Americans don't know. And you know that you're not a bad person. You're not a bad person for having a particular doctrine that you subscribe to. It just means you haven't been exposed very much to other doctrines. And in parts of our country, that's just the way it is. You know, my friend Tim Tyson, who's a historian in North Carolina, he said that when he was growing up in North Carolina, a Republican was like a polar bear. You know they exist, you just haven't ever seen one. You know, there are so many regions in our country, rural regions and southern regions, that are completely homogenous, both politically and racially. And in the urban centers, there's a new culture emerging that is, in many ways, it excludes the rural conservative and southern America. And so we're not bad people for subscribing to beliefs that come from particular doctrines. That's fine. Where it gets, I think, where we want to do a little better, is when we take those easy answers. So one person did a bad thing. One person said something that's really offensive to women. And let's paint them all that way, and let's dismiss them all. And let's call them all racists, and that way we can demonstrate how convinced we are that we're right and try to convince others. And unfortunately, it sometimes works. But if you really want, first of all, if you really want to understand the issues, taking a shortcut is not, I mean, it's just, you're not going to be able to understand the issues well enough to talk to someone who can really help you solve the problem. And what I've learned is that problems don't get solved in this country unless people work together across the political aisle. So if you really want to be a problem solver who makes people's lives better, you need to learn the issues better than they're all socialists and not from this country, or they're all racists and don't care about people of color. So having said that, I want to take the last few minutes and see, Stephen, if we can find some common ground on race, because I know you're frustrated with the birtherism and all of that stuff. And by the way, I know what you're talking about with the multi-layered birth certificate, and the fact is that whatever. But they did embellish it to make it look more like it was a brand new birth certificate when really all they had was this beat up, you know, old thing. But anyways, whatever. Almost everyone knows the president was born in Hawaii, and Hawaii was a part of the United States, but. Okay, I want to share with you a conversation, Stephen, that I had with a young libertarian in North Carolina who steered me towards some other Republicans in the area who are members of the county commissioners who are awesome. They're heroes. They really care about the constituents, and they stood up to this hospital corporation that wanted them to basically allow them to basically buy a hospital and close it without any real concern for the impact it was going to have on these people in this rural area who don't have another hospital for a long, 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 long ways. Anyways, this young guy, he was the clerk of a hotel we ended up staying in, Chocowinity, I hope I pronounced it right, North Carolina, and he's a libertarian. And he was basically telling me that, you know, the things that he really, really doesn't feel comfortable with and doesn't like about what conservatives say and do have to do with race. That he, you know, he was a white kid, but he, you know, he had gone to college on the West Coast, and he was very much about, you know, togetherness and equality and all that stuff. So his discomfort was with the racial issue. But what he really liked was the freedom, the libertarian ideas, and all of that. And I talked to him a little bit about the way I see the two political parties and their histories. And, you know, he wasn't aware that with regard to race, the two parties had essentially switched. But with regard to the interest of the business community, the bankers, the oil men, the war industry, two parties had remained the same. And so in a very simple, to overly simplified brush of history, what I said was that during the period leading up to the Civil War, the Republican Party emerged as the party that represents business interests, the industrialists of the North, who for moral reasons had decided that slavery was wrong, and also for some economic reasons wanted to, were at times unfair to the South in the policies that they sought, and that the Democratic Party was the older party. It was the coalition between labor and white Southerners who were still angry about, well, I'm sorry, not still angry, what am I saying? This is before the Civil War. White Southerners who wanted to maintain slavery. And ever since the Civil War, the two major forces in our political spectrum were that we had, on the one side, the Republican Party, who had been the party of Lincoln, the party that had freed the slaves, the party that had essentially fought and won a civil war. And then you had the Democratic Party, which had its stronghold in the South, that was, in many ways, they were for the little people. They were for labor, and they were for, you know, programs that help the poor, with the understanding that thanks to the redemption, quote-unquote redemption movement that installed Jim Crow, that these programs would not be extended to blacks. So programs to help the poor didn't really mean programs that help blacks back then. And then there was this political realignment that took place during the Civil Rights Movement. Even though just as many Republicans voted for civil rights legislation as Democrats did, because it was LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who after the assassination of President Kennedy, basically as part of his tribute and legacy and maybe on his own sense of doing what was godly and moral, he saw through things like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, legend has it, and maybe historians also have it, that he said, by doing this, I'm giving away the South to the Republican Party. And so sure enough, the polarity switched. And this is what really, I think, struck this young man who was the clerk of the all-night clerk. I talked to him pretty much all night when we arrived in North Carolina, one of our visits, is that for the first time in our history, what then happened was that party that basically harbors the grievances of the Confederacy, the grievances of the South. Many of them are valid grievances. Sherman's March, you know, they talk about war crimes against their people, the unfair economic practices that followed. It costs more to put something on a train if it emanated from the South, or just the fact that they're looked down upon or they're seen as the villains of history. All of those grievances easily exported to rural areas, right? And you can say, well, they don't understand us country folk. They look down on us. They got all educated and you know, uppity, and they look down on us. They think we're ignorant hicks and all that stuff. So those grievances, which had been opposed to the industry, they had balanced the power of money and industry, the oil men, the war profiteers, the bankers. They became basically fused as a single coalition. So you now have, for the first time, with the Southern Strategy, Richard Nixon's brilliant campaign of 1968. It, you know, the transition lasted all the way through Reagan in 1980. But the Southern Strategy basically created a solid coalition of Republicans in the South, basically fusing two arms. And we've only really talked about one arm, which is that the industrialists, they don't want regulations. They want their taxes low. They don't want to have to pay a minimum wage. You know, they want to do things that are best for profit. That's one. And the other is the resentment of the federal government, the resentment of the North, basically for forcing first emancipation and then later full citizenship for African Americans and civil rights. And now it spills into we don't like affirmative action and all that stuff. But those grievances had been a counterbalance to industry. But in the last 30, 40 years, those grievances were basically became aligned with industry. And if not for Watergate, if not for Roth-Perot, if not for the disaster in Iraq and Hurricane Katrina, I mean, I think that that coalition probably would have run the table for 30 or 40 years because it's almost unstoppable. Money plus the most powerful divide-and-conquer strategy that this country will ever and has ever known, and the reason why it was more powerful before than it is today is that you had these very different views, but a majority of people were on one side, and you know, basically racially, we were a majority white country, and so that was why the strategy worked so well. It was money plus that, and that's kind of what, you know, that's, well, let me just, Stephen, I just want to see if this has the same reaction on you as it did as this younger libertarian. I'm assuming he's younger than you. He was about 30. Go ahead.
You know, I don't think we probably had the same reaction. I think I'm going to probably reject a good portion of what you just said. Maybe not completely, but certainly, I mean, there's, you covered a lot of subjects there. I think that you just touched the surface on. I think when you look at the time after Reconstruction and you look at some of the animosity, as you talk about, between the races, a lot of that was born out, due in part, as you say, to a Southern population that felt kind of offended that the federal government was going to step in and tell them what to do. I think it's incorrect to think that everyone who fought on the side of the rebellious Union, the Confederacy, who rose up in violation and treason against our country, in my opinion, that all of those were based on concerns about slavery, and I would submit that for many it was not. There was a broader issue. Slavery became the fire button issue, but it wasn't the only issue. It certainly wasn't the only issue. And I think to suggest that after that animosity was based on racism, and that's why Republicans, these Southern white Southern whites switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party based solely on race, I think overlooks a lot of other things. It overlooks economic indicators that suggest that as you move out of poverty, and I don't think anybody would disagree with this, most rich people vote Republican. So there was commercial interests or business interests that were more represented by conservatives, by the Republican Party, than there were by Democrats. I think you start to see more of a divide in the ideology of those parties. And it's not unreasonable to think that these white Southerners who were very religious are going to start to align themselves more as there starts to become this divide with the party that adheres to what they consider traditional Christian values and things like that. I think that that's just kind of to say, well, they just switched because of race, I think is very simplistic explanation, in my opinion. No offense to you. Mm-hmm. I think that,
Let me just feed that back to you because that was enlightening for me. It's a great point that the Southern Strategy didn't only rely on anxiety and resentment that came from the civil rights movement based on race. There were also you just mentioned traditional Christian values. So what you're really talking about is abortion and views on homosexuality and also views on the place of women in society. Those were also things that formed an important part of that coalition that emerged in the 60s and the 80s. And I apologize if I said or sounded as if I was saying that essentially that
no worries.
No worries at all.
I'm picking up what you're laying down, and no worries at all. I completely understand that. I would say to you that people of faith, unfortunately not the most vocal ones, not the ones that get the press, are concerned with issues above and beyond abortion and homosexuality and things like that. And if you listen to my program, you'll hear me taking those other ones, especially this week, because this week's the throwdown episode, and I'm going to be calling out both sides. You'll hear me speak to that a little bit more. But in regards to the Southern Strategy, I mean, someone needs to explain that to me, the Southern Strategy, because my understanding is that it's the idea that he was going to take animosity based on race and then somehow win the South. But he lost a lot of the states that supposedly tried that in. And I think if you're going to further that argument to say that racial politics was inherent in you know, possibly either the Nixon administration or just the GOP, systemically at that point, you know, I would argue if you look at what Nixon's administration did in regards to education, things like that, he had done, his administration did more to further race relations and to elevate colored people and minorities than anybody previous to him. And I'll take great exception with some of the theories that abound about how who really supported and who really advocated the Civil Rights Acts and why FDR signed it. So, but we can agree to disagree on that point.
Okay, LBJ. So LBJ. Let's talk about that a little bit. Okay, so first of all, I'm an independent as well, and as Joe mentioned earlier, and there's something that Reverend Barber from the NAACP said that I really like. He said, we have no permanent friends and no permanent enemies in the NAACP when you're talking about party politics. We only have permanent issues. And so I'm not sure what you were going to say about LBJ and signing the Civil Rights Act and why he did it and all that stuff. And I don't mind if you come back to it, because I want to learn more about this era. I've really been obsessed with it in the last few years. But the thing I wanted to tell you is that both parties over the years, and with a lot of overlap, have basically made coalitions with the South with the understanding that the South was essentially going to be a one-party, and the reason why it was a one-party block goes all the way back to the 1870s, when the Republican Party was the party that had freed the slaves, and it consisted of black voters, recently emancipated, and, well, a portion of white people who believed in that right, and then a lot of carpetbaggers, right, basically northern soldiers and northern generals who came in to try to take advantage of the fact that the government would be in their hands, in the hands of the Republican Party, and then they could basically, dole out the government jobs, and it was very lucrative to be just like the postmaster or whatever. And so there was some corruption involved and all that stuff. The truth is that it never really got off the ground because of the Ku Klux Klan and because of the white liners and all of these organizations that were created to basically annihilate the Republican Party. They basically killed people, whites and blacks, for voting Republican. The whole practice of lynching and all the terrorism that we associate with the KKK was basically designed to prevent one of the two political parties, and you could also say to prevent black people from voting. Because the truth was is that in a lot of those states, Alabama, Mississippi, if everyone who was a man who was allowed to vote, then the Republicans would always have a lot more slaves than there were slave owners and poor whites. So anyway, I just tell you all this because, like, Democrats like JFK and George Wallace, who had been a Democrat, it was all about the coalitions, right? And so JFK used to say things that were really unfair and inaccurate about race relations and about history of the South and all that. He wrote them in his book, Profiles of Courage. Like, he celebrates people that today we would look at as basically racist war criminals in order to forge that coalition. And basically all the Southern Strategy is that one party dropped the ball. You know, the Democratic Party dropped the ability to forge that coalition with the one-party South, and the Republican Party picked it up. And they picked it up in ways that were a lot more delicate than what the Democrats had been doing throughout the decades. I think that most people would just be able to look at the map and say it was all blue until this period of transition, which is basically the 70s. And since then, it's been pretty much all red until very recently. Back to you, Stephen.
You know, I really don't have anything to say to that. I mean, I can't completely disagree with you. And the thing that frustrates me sometimes is just that there's so many things that get thrown out and are just easily, you know, these bumper sticker, you know, history revisions and these, you know, these complex areas that are kind of just boiled down to this black and white issue, no pun intended, where it's just this real simple thing, and it's not. It's all very complex. And one of the things that I have adopted as my strategy is, as I said, I'm a stay-at-home father. I've got twin boys that are 6 years old. There are certain things, you know, most of my concerns have to do with them. They have to concern with the future of the country, with how much money we're spending, with what our rights are, what our liberties are, and just how we're treating each other as citizens. And so you know, so much of this stuff, it's like, If that's your issue and you want to go argue about the Southern strategy or you want to have those discussions, that's great. My kids don't care about that. My kids don't care about the Southern strategy. My kids don't care about who signed what civil rights acts. My kids don't care about, you know, honestly, where Barack Obama was born. Okay, and if he was born on Mars or in Indonesia or in China or who cares, it doesn't matter. It's a stupid argument, and it's not, you know, we don't care which parties did this and who was the bigger jerk because my kids were just born, and they already owe the government an incredible amount of money, and I feel strange bringing them out into this world where it's like, man, you need to watch what you say and you need to watch what you talk to, and they tell me, hey, Dad, I want to go to Mars, and I want to be able to tell them, cool, you know, set that goal, go for it, but I can't see that we're going to be a country past 50 years from now. If we can't get our stuff together and start working together. And so there's so much of that stuff, whatever. I don't care. Win the, you know, and just like with our earlier caller, okay, win that argument. Let's do something about it. You know, I'm willing to concede everything. I'm willing to concede every single point any person wants to make against me or my beliefs or my ideology. If at the end of that conversation they say, but I agree with you on this, let's go try to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason why I went through all of that is that I think the way that a lot of progressives look at the conservative platform right now is that there's the mercantile interests, right? There's the industrialist interests, the traditional Republican Party back to its inception, where they don't like that because of pollution and all that stuff, right? Okay. And then there's the other part that it basically sounds like, John C. Calhoun basically making the argument pre-Civil War of why it's not anybody's business other than the state's to determine who is a human being and who is a slave. And I know, of course, that's not how you feel, but see, this body of thought that, you know, government is a leviathan that we must watch, you know, it goes all the way back to King George, and that's where I sort of expected you to talk about, you know, fear of government when I talked about that earlier. That that's one strain. One strain is, I'm sorry, I got distracted by the lady telling me I have 60 seconds left in the show. There's one strain that's about mercantile interests, and they don't want government restricting their ability to profit. And then there's the other strain that's about we don't want the government basically telling us who's a human being and who's deserving of equal justice under the law. One of those things is I think, a balance that needs to be struck. On the other hand, the question of who is deserving equal justice under the law, I don't think that's something that we can really balance. I think that's an absolute. We have to respect all people's rights. And I think that most libertarians are with us on that. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And for all of, you know, all of my perspective, I try to put within the scope of the Constitution. And, you know, we can, you know, people like to argue about what it meant then and you know, and we built all these laws to change it and to give people those rights that I say if we ever fulfill the Constitution is all that we need. So I think that, you know, all people are created equal. And I think that's just fundamental. And that's where I butt heads with some of these people on the right where it's like, you know, even that you're expressing here, as you pound the Constitution and talk about how great it is, and then you just act completely different. That's just a fundamental rights. Fundamental rights, you know, we have to appreciate, we have to respect, and those are the people that I have a problem with when you're trying to tell me that, for whatever reason, my fundamental right to pursue what is not in the Constitution, but I think speaks to the spirit of the Constitution, my life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. You know, then that's where we have a problem, and that's where I don't, you know, I just don't even want to talk to those people anymore. I want to talk to you guys. I want to talk to the people I've heard in this room. I want to talk to the people, you know, that are proud enough of how they live and how they, the decisions they make, their values, to say however you do it isn't gonna make a difference to me. That is just inherent. That's just so easy. And if you can't get that, I don't have time to talk to you. You're not gonna get anything else I'm talking about. And I didn't mean to go off topic the last time you threw it my way. I can certainly speak to the ideas of big government, and all too often I feel that as I talk about, you know, I say big government, but all somebody hears on the left is no government. You know, and this is kind of like earlier, I feel like sometimes when I talk about concerns about illegal immigration, all anybody on the left hears is immigration. You know, and there are valid concerns that I think both sides have, and valid perspectives that both sides have. And one of my concerns is big government. And if you have no concern about big government, then help me understand why, because I can look at history and just know the nature of government, even the best governments. I agree with whichever guy said that it's a fitful serve and a fearful master, a fitful servant and a fearful master. Government wants to get bigger because, you know, it's because that's what it wants to do. And I don't know. I'm just, at this point, I'm kind of tired, man, and I feel like I'm treading over old ground, but I really...
Okay. No worries. Well, look, we got to wrap up this show. I want to thank Stephen and Tamara. Do you give your last name out, Stephen?
Yeah, Stephen Vandergast. It's Vandergast. You can find me there on Facebook if you're interested. And, again, it's not this Thursday, but next Thursday. Move the Middle Radio. I will let you get some very nice people in your audience. I do sometimes work a little blue. Which means I occasionally use a little bit of profanity. It's not excessive, but I hope you guys all will join, and I'll let you go. Thanks a lot for letting me talk.
Okay, I just friended you on Facebook. It looks like you have a little profanity in your profile picture. thank you so much for joining us.
Really, be aware.
It made the show to have you on there. I really thank you, and I'm going to call you tomorrow to ask you to participate more. I think Dan Aronson, who is a libertarian-leaning independent, is going to love what became of his show tonight, and it's really thanks to you. I want to thank our other callers, Marianne, Jack, and Joe, and you're listening to Coffee Party Radio. This is Press 1 for Democracy. Eric Byler, guest hosting for Dan Aronson. You can find us at coffeepartyusa.com or facebook.com/coffeeparty. Thank you very much for listening, and hopefully we'll talk to you on the next show. That's Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern, Lunch with Loudon. Thanks, everyone.